The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And television's Daniel Freeb.
Hello. Hello.
Hello, chaps. How are we all after the tour?
We're fine. We're not on television.
Rested.
So I'm no longer television's whatever. Anyway.
Just Daniel Freeb. Yeah. Where are you, Daniel?
I'm in Mallorca at the moment. Between tour and the Vuelta. Traditional.
How's the heat out there?
It's not too bad. It's pretty humid, but I think it's pretty much the same as the rest of Europe at the moment, which is the whole of Europe.
How hot?
Scorcho, isn't it?
It is. It has been. Yeah. How hot is it in Watford, Lionel?
Don't know. I don't know, but it's probably the same temperature that it is here. It's cooled down a lot today. No need to invoke the extreme weather protocol for podcasting.
No, indeed. This is our first regular podcast since the Tour de France. We released a couple of press conference episodes last week, and we're in that period now between the Tour and the Vuelta. The Vuelta is coming up pretty soon, isn't it? How many days
it
to
is?
Go?
Oh, I don't know. It's two and a half weeks now until the big start in Malaga.
Ready?
I hope it's not going to be 45 degrees in Malaga, that's for sure.
Are we ready for another Grand Tour, chaps?
Not quite yet. Just on the heat, have you chaps, I don't suppose you've been watching the Volta a Portugal, have you?
No.
Have you seen the fire engines parked up in every village, dousing the riders with water?
The riders.
Various complaints and reports of riders pulling out through heat exhaustion. I don't know.
Have you been watching it, Daniel?
Have I been watching it?
Yeah.
The RTP, the Portuguese state television, have a very good streaming service, so I tend to watch the big stages, the mountain stages.
You've always been a fan of that race, haven't
you?
Yeah,
well, I covered it in 2008 and I sort of fell in love with it. That was probably, I mean, it's become a bit of a caricature of a grand tour. It used to be 20 odd stages, now it's a week and a half, and it's earned a pretty invidious reputation for being a haven of, well, without putting too fine a point on it, doping in the last 15 years, and been various scandals, various unlikely performances. When I covered it in 2008, it was a particularly interesting addition because it was awash with sort of exiles from the Operación Puerto. A lot of Spanish riders who had been involved in Operación Puerto had found homes in Portuguese teams. And over the last 10 years, it's gradually lost its luster in terms of the field that it now attracts. It used to attract some of the best stage races in Europe, even, you know, at the start of the noughties. That's no longer the case. And it's a whole different cast of characters from what we see in World Tour racing. And there are interesting subplots, like the rivalry between two great, what are known as two great football clubs, Porto and Sporting Club of Lisbon. They both have cycling divisions, and they're the two main domestic teams, really. And the Porto team has been completely dominant over the past few years, and some of their performances have been noteworthy, shall we say.
And of course, this year is the 30th anniversary of Kane Theakston's overall victory in the Tour of Portugal. Rich, you must remember that, British rider.
I do remember that, and a friend of the podcast, Tim Harris, races a professional in Portugal a lot as well, and familiar with that race.
Yeah, back then it was, as you say, Daniel, I think it was 18 days in 1988. Kane Theakston won it. It was only the third non-Portuguese rider to win the race. It's a real, really is a home affair, or it certainly was then. Probably still is now.
Well,
really.
This covers the Tour of Portugal from your news roundup, Lionel. But before you launch into that, I am just back from holiday myself, but it was a busman's holiday because I went to the San Sebastian Classic on Saturday. And we'll hear a bit from that in part two of the podcast. But can you give us the news roundup, please, Lionel? Expecting a meaty one today.
Yeah, there's a lot to catch up on since the Tour de France. So I'll rattle through it as quickly as possible, hopefully not missing too much. On the day the Tour finished in Paris, there was the Ride London. The Wright London Surrey Classic. Pascal Ackermann of Bora Hansgrohe won that. And then Ackermann has won the first two stages of the Tour of Poland, which is ongoing at the moment. Other stage winners there are Scotland's finest, Rich, Ali Hodge,
yeah.
Alvaro Hodge of Quickstep. And yesterday, Michał Kwiatkowski, of course, Polish champion, Team Sky rider, just completed the Tour de France. He won stage four and has taken the overall lead. That race finishes at the weekend. Other lots and lots of road racing going on at the moment. The Tour de Wallonie in Belgium was won by Tim Wellens. The Tour of Denmark was won by Wout van Aert. And he was caught up in the middle of a strange story that we haven't quite got to the bottom of yet. Aqua Blue basically announced a merger with Van Aert's team, Verandas Willems, and then Verandas Willems they basically objected to that and said that, fake news was the phrase that was bandied around. We still don't quite know what is happening there. I've tried to get to the bottom of it. We'll do so in the next week or so, or maybe it will all be resolved by next week's episode, who knows. But clearly Aqua Blue have got plans. Verandas Willems may not be fully appraised of those plans, who knows. Richard, as you said, the San Sebastian Classic was the big World Tour race a week after the Tour de France finished. Julian Alaphilippe won, adding that race win to the two stage wins in the King of the Mountains jersey he won at the Tour. He won ahead of Bauke Mollema and Anthony Rue, but the race was really marred by a bad crash which took out Mikel Landa, Pierre Latour, and probably worst of all, Egan Bernal, who suffered some pretty bad facial injuries and has had to have operations and will need quite a lot of dental work. So by the looks of it, Bernal's season is over. Landa's place in the Vuelta is in doubt, contrasting reports at the moment about whether or not he'll be fit to start the race in Malaga. Meanwhile, the European Championships have been going on in Glasgow. The women's road race was won by former world champion Marta Bastianelli of Italy, ahead of Mariana Voss and Lisa Brennauer. The race was kind of brought to life by a long attack from Great Britain's Sophie Wright, but it all came back together with a sort of small bunch sprint at the finish. Brennauer's bronze in the road race came the morning after she'd won gold in the pursuit on the track, ahead of Katie Archibald. Ethan Hayter, probably the outstanding rider on the men's side for Great Britain, he won the Omnium ahead of Elia Viviani, and also two bronzes, one in the team pursuit, which Italy won with Viviani in the team, and the other in the Madison with Oliver Wood. Hayter will be riding as a stagiaire for Sky a little bit later on this season.
Cool, blimey, that's not the best name, is it? Hayter to have if you're going to be riding for Team Sky.
Haters gonna hate.
Yeah. Anyway.
Hey? Oh dear. Well, he can't do much about that, can he? So stuck with it. Great Britain won the women's team pursuit. Laura Kenny and Katie Archibald teamed up for the Madison, where they just missed out on a medal. Laura Kenny also won the elimination, and Archibald was second in the Omnium behind the Netherlands' Kirsten Wild. Daniel, as you mentioned, the Tour of Portugal was really struck by the extreme heat across the southern part of Europe, riders pulling out with dehydration and heat exhaustion. And the slightly bizarre story that's emerged from that is that the UCI's extreme weather protocol only applies to World Tour and HC category races, not to 0.1 category races, which seems to be a strange anomaly. A couple of the stages, I think, were shortened slightly, but as you say, riders were... Well, the temperature on the ground must have been pushing 50 degrees. And as you say, the fire brigade were out spraying the peloton in as many towns and villages as possible. Quite a bit of transfer news, which we'll cover, I think. Well, it's ongoing, isn't it? This is transfer season now that the teams and riders are allowed to announce their plans for 2019 after the August the 1st date. Michael Valgren is moving from Astana to Dimension Data, which has raised a few eyebrows. Slightly strange move for Valgren, who's had an impressive year. Andre Greipel will be going from Lotto Soudal to Fortuneo. TJ Van Garderen from BMC to Education First.
29. He's still 29, TJ Van Garderen. Can you believe that? He was 29 3 months ago, and he's still 29 today. Amazing.
Has he got some? Is he Benjamin Button? Or has he got some kind of
extraordinary?
Some kind of device that stops time. He does seem to have been around a long time. But maybe that team will be a good fit for him. EF. But he'll be joined there by Alberto Bettiol, who's going back to the Slipstream team after joining BMC. Bahrain have done a bit of recruiting as well. Dylan Tuns from BMC, Marcel Seberg from Lotto, and Phil Bauhaus from Sunweb are all joining Bahrain. And Guillaume van Kiersbroek is leaving Wanty to join the as-yet-to-be-named BMC CCC team. And another bit of news from BMC Racing is that Simon Gerrans, the former Milan-San Remo winner, will retire at the end of the season. That's probably all for now. There are just a couple of bits of breaking news just as we were completing production of this week's episode. The first is that Team Sky's Gianni Moscon has been suspended for 5 weeks by the UCI after he was thrown out of the Tour de France for throwing an arm at Fortuneo's rider Elie Gesbert. So 5 weeks on the sidelines for Moscon. Also, it's been confirmed that Caleb Ewan will join Lotto Soudal next season. That had been rumoured strongly during the Tour de France, but that has now been confirmed. Caleb Ewan will be sprinting for Lotto Soudal next season.
A community around the world, stories and films with the most compelling characters, the world's finest apparel, explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thanks very much to Rafa, our headline sponsor, without whose support we wouldn't be here landing in your podcast app once a week or daily during the Grand Tours. I want to mention the first in a new series of Rafa-produced collectible handbooks for cyclists getting started in road cycling, which is designed to guide you through the beginning of your journey as a cyclist. There are riding tips from the likes of former Giro winner Andy Hampston and cyclocross rider Helen Wyman, but it also features charming illustrations by Laura Quick. And if you go to the Rafa website and click on Rafa Manuals, you can see some equally charming animated shorts, also by Laura Quick. Go to rafa.cc to have a look. Thank you, Lionel, for that extensive news roundup. Simon Gerrans, or Gerrans? I can't believe he's retiring and we still haven't established.
Well, we have established, exactly. Haven't we? That was a have very we? Rare slip from Napalm. The heat's getting to him. He's very flustered.
Napalm has persisted in calling him Gerrans throughout the years.
Well,
his nickname is... You hear people calling him Gero.
Well, we'll have none of that on the podcast, Lionel.
Well, no, of course not. But, you know, Gero, I mean...
he's Gerrans if you're in Italy.
It is a hard...
When he's riding the Giro, he's Gerrans. Everywhere else is Gerrans. Anyway.
Oh, well, he's retiring now, so... Unless he becomes a sports director, I'll not have to mention him too much in the news roundup.
Have we been, well, I said earlier we'll hear from San Sebastian in the next part, but have we been watching much of the racing, chaps, Poland and Burgos? You've obviously had your eyes glued to events in Portugal, Daniel, but have you been able to catch up on any other racing?
Well, this is a great time of year for the cycling hipster, isn't it? Because you've got races like Volta a Portugal, you've got the Volta a Burgos with its purple leader's jersey, which I always enjoy. That started a couple of days ago. But I tend to limit myself to the slightly more recherché races at this time of year. I shun them.
What about Poland races?
Given your
Polish roots.
Well, exactly. I haven't been paying too much attention to the Tour of Poland yet, although I'm glad to see that Michał Kwiatkowski is actually riding this year, because he's obviously been the sort of standard bearer for Polish cycling for a while, but he hasn't actually taken part in the Tour of Poland very often in his career, and he won at San Sebastian.
Yeah, he won at San Sebastian last year, of course. And I did catch the stage yesterday. We're speaking on Wednesday, so Tuesday's stage, with a nasty summit finish. And it was a fantastic ride by Kwiatkowski, perfectly judged, because it was a very, very difficult finish. And Richard Carapaz, who is, I believe, Movistar's best general classification rider these days, isn't he? He's had their best finish in a Grand Tour for quite some time, with fourth at the Giro this year. But he took a flyer pretty early on. He did misjudge it, and Kwiatkowski left it to the last couple hundred metres, and it was a really, really difficult finish, and he rode an excellent race, I thought. So yeah, it's probably a very important race for him to be riding well in.
What about the European Championships?
That's mainly indoor cycling, isn't it?
Well, there's outdoor cycling as well, Daniel. Nothing. They had the women's road race at the weekend. The time trials are today, in fact. And
Ellen van Dijk has won the women's. There you are, breaking news.
Some live news roundup slotted in. Mm. If we make this podcast about 4 hours long, we'll be able to bring you the men's time trial as well. Well, we can bring you the results of the European Championship time trials. Ellen van Dijk completed a Dutch 1-2 in the women's race, beating Anna van der Breggen by only 2 seconds. And Trixie Warrack of Germany took the bronze medal, but she was 1:09 back from Ellen van Dijk. So a convincing victory for the Dutch woman there. And in the men's race, Belgium's Victor Campenaerts won by another narrow margin, just a second his margin of victory over Jonathan Castroviejo of Spain. Max Schachmann of Germany was third. Britain's Alex Dowsett was fifth. And Ryan Mullen of Ireland was sixth. And the men's road race is at the weekend. And, well, there's a pretty good field for it. Could be quite an interesting race. It's quite an urban circuit in Glasgow. Well, as you know, Rich, well, as anyone who's been to Glasgow knows, there's quite a lot of climbing involved, sort of steep city streets.
Unfortunately.
Made for a good race.
Unfortunately, Glasgow's finest World Tour professional, Michael Storer, originally of Australia, now settled in Glasgow, is riding the Tour of Poland, and he won't be there. I expected him to do extremely well in the Tour of Poland, but didn't go too well yesterday. Anyway,
but this is not the Eurovision Song Contest we're talking about here. He doesn't qualify for the European Championships, so he couldn't have ridden it anyway, could he?
He's a star in the making, that boy. Mark my words. Anyway,
yeah, the other Scottish rider, Theo Gegenhart, who I spoke to at San Sebastian, he was very sorry not to be riding the European Championships, and indeed said that his girlfriend Hannah Barnes, who recently suffered a broken collarbone, also very disappointed to not be riding in Glasgow.
But yeah, to answer your question, Rich, I've quite enjoyed all the indoor cycling, an opportunity to watch it. Well, some days I've had morning, afternoon and evening sessions. There's been a lot to enjoy, although I still can't quite get my head around the tempo race, in which is part of the Omnium, which seems to change format. Well, it's changed format, I think, 18 months ago. It's now 4 bunch races, kind of all much of a muchness, really. A scratch race, a points race, this tempo race, which is basically more or less a sprint every lap, where you get the winner gets 1 point. I mean, I possibly got that wrong, but it was like trying to watch a magic eye painting, to be honest. What's the other one? The elimination race, which is always good value, both... when there's a standalone elimination race as well. It's been a good watch. It's quite a it's enjoyed a real kind of boost in profile, joining up with the other sports, notably sort of swimming and rowing, gymnastics, to be a sort of multi-sport event. It's got a mini Olympic feel to it, and with the athletics happening in Berlin, I mean, from the viewpoint of the sofa, the fact that the some events are in Glasgow, some are in Berlin, it's almost a Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb championships.
We just need
Berlin and Scotland.
We just need the dressage to take place in Watford, and then we'll have it covered.
That would be the perfect event for Watford, I tell you.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Well, you set up the finale of the race there with your attack on the climb.
Yeah, it's true. We lose our leader in the crash before the final lap, and I wait for him and I come back, and then I thought, yeah, now I just need to try. Okay.
It's like a race that suits you?
Yeah, I think so.
You like it?
Yeah, really, I like it.
Good ride, love it. Well, we're played in there by Antoine Tolhoek, the young Dutch rider on the Lotto NL Jumbo team, and we'll hear why in a moment or two. But before that, we heard the message from Science and Sport, our sponsor, Science and Sport. Very grateful to them for their support, and you can still, of course, get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. We're also still taking questions for the Science and Sport experts, so please email us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. We've got lots of questions. Hope to meet up with them before the Vuelta. But we heard, as I said, from Antoine Tolhoek, young Dutchman, just out of the Tour de France, fresh from the Tour, as many of the riders in the Clásica San Sebastián were. It's a mix, really, of riders almost emerging from hibernation from a period over the summer that they've had off, and maybe building up for the Vuelta. and those riders who are straight out of the Tour de France. And Tolleck was the guy who really ignited things on the final climb, the Murgel Tontora, quite a new climb, which has been added to the circuit. It comes on a strange little loop that goes out from San Sebastian through quite an industrial part of the city, around some back roads and up a very narrow, very steep climb. It's up to 22% in places. And Tolleck put in a great attack, got quite a gap, but eventually Bauke Mollema came across and then Julian Alaphilippe bridged across to him. And those two fought it out. No surprise at all that Alaphilippe won in San Sebastian. But I was there. I was happened to be there on holiday, and so I was able to catch the race.
Working holiday, Rich. Putting me to shame.
I
left you in Biarritz and I drove the Skoda all the way home, knowing that you were off on your holidays. But what was it like? I've never really had the energy to even contemplate going to a race a week after the Tour de France finishes. And when you look at the top 10, even further down, probably the top 20, well, nine of the top 10 rode the Tour de France. You could probably take Rigoberto Urán, who finished sixth, out of that, maybe because he crashed on the cobbles and pulled out of the Tour a couple of days later. But everyone else, I think, finished the Tour in the top 10. And then they're back in action at a really high level race, you know, 6 days later, when I'm still working through my laundry at that stage. It's always struck me as amazing that they managed to, you know, peak again, kind of thing, take their tour form. And it's no real surprise that Alaphilippe, I mean, you know, banging form at the Tour, two stage wins, King of the Mountains jersey, looked very lively right through the Pyrenees as he wrapped up that Tour de France jersey. So no real surprise that he was still pinging 6 days later. But what was it like? I mean, what's the city like? You're always raving about San Sebastian as a place. Did it live up to expectation?
Yeah, I mean, I know it very well, San Sebastian. I've spent a lot of time there, and I've always been curious to be there for the race. The Heiskebel is the famous climb just outside San Sebastian. I've actually ridden up that, and it used to be the focal point for the race, and it isn't so much anymore because of this new finishing circuit they've added, and it's all quite controlled. I mean, beautiful countryside around there, around the Basque country, but it was all quite controlled, in particular by Team Sky setting up for Egan Bernal. We'll get on to what happened to him in a moment or two. But I've always been quite curious to be there when the race is on, and it's a, you know, the Basque Country, we've covered it a lot in the cycling podcast. It's a real heartland for cycling. So many great Basque riders and so many fans of the sport there. But San Sebastian's a very kind of cosmopolitan, young, thrusting city with it's on a beach. So, you know, it was business as usual on the beach. The beach was absolutely mobbed with people, but the city centre itself was absolutely mobbed as well with cycling fans. You know, there was a real buzz around the race, and it was nice to be there and to get a flavour of that, really. The race was overshadowed, certainly. I mean, a great winner in Alaphilippe, but the crash, which was a freak crash, and Ben King, with the Dimension Data rider, was responsible. He kind of was at the front. He turned around, and after turning around, a rider kind of rode in front of him, and they collided and caused this pileup behind them. And it was on the run-in into the city before the finishing circuit. The race wasn't really on at the time, and it didn't look particularly high speed, although it's hard to know how fast they were going. But some of the injuries suffered were appalling, you know, and really sickening. I mean, Mikel Landa and Egan Bernal in particular, both of them taken away in neck braces to hospital, and Bernal's face was a real mess. You know, he lost quite a few teeth. He's had surgery on his nose, and, you know, his season looks to be over. And Landa, the local boy, obviously, and Bernal in particular, were the guys we were expecting fireworks from on that final climb. And so the race was deprived of that real interest that had been building up to, a bit like Milan-San Remo, where there's this anticipation all day about what's going to happen on the Poggio. Here, it was all about what was going to happen on the far sort of newer and less established Murgel Tontora climb. And, you know, I think Bernal, instead of Mollema and Alaphilippe, it could equally have been Landa and Bernal away on that climb and fighting out for the finish. We'll never know, but really, really awful, awful scenes. Pierre Latour also suffered a pretty nasty injury, and he is probably out for the season. And yeah, it did. It's a shame because it did cast a shadow over the race, and left a kind of quite a sick feeling about that, because, you know, it wasn't. It looked a completely innocuous crash, but clearly it wasn't. And these injuries suffered by these guys were really nasty.
Yeah, they came off very badly, Bernal in particular, as you say. And you're right, it's inevitably going to cast a bit of a shadow over over the outcome. But take nothing away from Alaphilippe's victory. I mean, you know, he sort of came to prominence as a... well, somebody who you thought, well, this guy is going to win on the Mer de Huy in Flèche Wallonne, or he's going to win Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and really he's broadened his repertoire significantly since then. You know, he won a stage of the Vuelta last year with a little. That was a little punchy uphill finish. It was the day after I left the race, I think. And you know, when he didn't sort of. I was expecting him to win at the Tour on, say, Mer de Bretagne. I wasn't really expecting him to. Be quite as aggressive in the mountains. I mean, I certainly don't want to say beginner's luck for him at the Tour, because it certainly wasn't. But, you know, he's not the sort of rider that people are going to let get away into breaks in the Tour de France, you know, as not even lightly. I don't necessarily mean lightly, but, you know, he wasn't marked as somebody who would finish in, you know, the top 10 overall this year. But in future years, you know, why not? Because you look at the Roll of Honour on the San Sebastian Classic. I mean, it's a relatively young race. It's, you know, 1981. It's younger than I am. And over the years, you know, it's been won by some, you know, proper climbers, hasn't it? Marino Lajarreta, Gertjan Ternisa, and then, you know, a whole raft of kind of Tour de France riders through the 90s.
The controversial Lance Armstrong.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, before that, Miguel Indurain, Gianni Bugno, Raul Alcala, Claudio Chiappucci, Armand de las Cuevas, who won in 1994, who passed away this week. I didn't actually mention that in the news roundup. Very sad news that the former French champion died at the age of only 50. But he's a past winner of the race as well. And you mentioned Lance Armstrong. Yeah, it was his first pro race, wasn't it? In 1992, I think. And he finished dead last. The following year, he won the world title. And then in 1995, he won San Sebastian as well. So, you know, it's a race that's... well, you know, the colourful Lance Armstrong has decorated its Roll of Honour as well. And in recent years, it kind of that blend of tour rider slash classics rider. You know, you think of, you know, the year Alejandro Valverde won it, 2008, 2014. You know, it's a kind of race that really suits him. And so you're getting an impression of what kind of rider Julian Alaphilippe is going to develop into. It's quite interesting. And obviously, coming out of the Tour with such good form, you know, you see the riders that were in the top 10, so many of them were kind of ever-present in the breaks, weren't they? Particularly in the final week, Robert Hissing, Yonny Zagiere, Steven Kruiswijk, and, well, the baby-faced Antoine Tolhoek, who we should just remember, back in December on the Lotto NL Jumbo training camp, he was caught with some sleeping pills in his possession and you know, that was against the team's internal rules, and he was suspended for a couple of months. But he's he's put that behind him, and he was one of the most impressive young riders of the Tour, wasn't he?
He was very impressive at the Tour. He also at the Vuelta last year had this policy of not speaking to the media, but he seems to have snapped out of that. And I spoke to him a couple of times at the Tour and found him quite interesting, actually. And you know, he ended up 10th in San Sebastian, Lotto NL Jumbo, packing 8th, 9th, and 10th. Not great from a team point of view.
Sean Kelly has a you know, he has a golden rule about that. If you've got three riders in a group and they all finish, you know, stacked up like that, then there's got to be some kind of internal inquest. But
well,
to be fair, none of them really had much of a sprint on them, so it wasn't like it wasn't like they were robbed or anything.
I mentioned for Greg Van Avermaet, who is just a machine. He goes on fourth at San Sebastian, such a versatile rider. Anthony Roux, the French champion, third, the only rider in the top 10 who hadn't ridden the Tour. I mean, it was odd going from the rhythm of the Tour to having a week off and then going to San Sebastian. I can only imagine it was the same for the riders. But for I was certainly out of the habit of, you know, going to the start and the finish and speaking to the right people. Alaphilippe and Mollema both eluded me at the finish, partly because, well, Alaphilippe had to rush off to ride a criterium the next day. So it's a strange a one-day race is always strange when people disperse, they scatter in a way that they don't at the Grand Tours where you're locked in more. But I did speak to Dan Martin at the finish line. I mean, he was unlucky. He was caught up in the crash just on the approach to that steep climb on the finishing circuit. But he was 12th in the end, and here's what he had to say.
What happened out there in the closing stages?
I think it's just the level of bike handling now in these races is just freaking horrendous, you know? It's like, if it's a big road going into a small road, like, guys just don't want to brake, and a Katusha guy just crashed and then threw his bike into the middle of the road and blocked the road, you know? It's like, he was right in front of me, you know? He was never going to make the corner, just slid out. It's like, you know, it's the way it goes, you know? I was pretty good position. The team rode incredible all day. Like, looked after me amazingly all day, and it's just like, yeah, I mean, it's just a pity. I don't know if I did have the legs to go with the guys, because I felt like I didn't have that explosiveness at the end, but I'm just disappointed with the guy where the guys rode, I felt really, really good all day. But yeah, that's the way it goes.
You've come out of the tour, obviously, and, well, you had a good tour. I think you were pretty pleased with your tour, weren't you?
Yeah. That no, was a good tour, you know. It could have been better, but I wasn't supposed to come to this race. But because of how I finished the tour, I felt really good still. I said to the team, "Look, let's try and win San Sebastian," you know. And it's historically, like, coming off the tour, riding GC, I've never been that good here. And it's kind of continued that trend, unfortunately. But maybe we'll have another go in the future.
What's next for you, Dan, then, apart from fatherhood?
I don't know yet. You know, that's the fatherhood bit's kind of changing. Kind of makes my program these next few months, but we'll see. We haven't really decided yet on the Vuelta or go to Canada yet, but we'll make that decision in the next week or so, and then look forward to those two coming.
So that was Dan Martin suggesting that he might ride the Vuelta, which I was quite surprised to hear, but the thing that seems uppermost in his mind is impending fatherhood. His wife is expecting twins, so I don't know whether that will have a bearing on whether he rides the Vuelta or not, but as I say, I was surprised to hear that he might ride the Vuelta. Another rider I spoke to at the start, and so before, obviously, the terrible crash for his team leader, Egan Bernal, is Theo Gegenhardt, who's become a real good friend of Bernal's this year at Team Sky. And I spoke to Theo because we haven't heard from him this year, and it's really been a bit of a breakout season for him. He's ridden extremely well from Tour California onwards, really. The Dauphiné as well, he rode well. And he is trying to get into the Team Sky team for the Vuelta, which would be his first Grand Tour.
Back to racing. And your mate Egan did a fantastic Tour de France. What was it like sitting at home or wherever you were watching that?
Yeah, it was nice, I think. It's the first time in my career that I've been racing with teammates and opposition directly before the tour in the Dauphiné. So was really nice to watch Egan and also Geraint animating the race, obviously riding incredibly. And day by day, I think it was cool to watch Egan, I would say, probably get better as the race went on, really, and certainly be more and more instrumental. It was super nice. I think just makes you motivated to try and be there in the future, because, yeah, still everything around cycling revolves around that race, and also it's the race that everyone outside of cycling knows. So no, it was really cool to watch it, and yeah, I was in kind of a longer training period and a bit of altitude and stuff, so it was nice some days to get home and watch the race after training and see how the guys were getting on.
You saw Geraint obviously close up at the Dauphiné. Were you surprised to see how he rode at the Tour?
No, I don't think so. I left the Dauphiné with the impression that Geraint probably had like maybe another gear in the Dauphiné, which he didn't really. In the end, the way the race panned out, maybe he didn't have to use it, you know, with the gap we got in the team time trial and you know, in spite of his crash in the prologue, he already had quite a sizable lead going into those last 4 days. So our approach was, I wouldn't say very conservative, but far more conservative than it could have been. So I was interested to see how he was going to move forward from the Dauphiné, and I think he showed that he had that next level. And watching him win on La Rosière was really cool, because I can't say I was cheering against Nieve, because he's a super nice guy and we were teammates last year, but it was almost identical situation from the Dauphiné, with one guy up the road on La Rosière. And I really thought, oh, maybe G's going to be conservative. He didn't really need to attack Dumoulin and Kay to go. And I really wanted him to win that stage because he looked so good. And then, well, when he went in the last K, was incredible to watch. And made up for the same situation in the Dauphiné when he came, whatever it was, 10 seconds short of the rider from Astana. So, well, it was really cool to watch, yeah.
But watching them as well, do you feel that, you know, knowing where you are in relation to those guys, Egan in particular, you must feel that those sorts of performances, that sort of level, is within your grasp?
Yeah, I hope so. You can only hope in the end, though. But the last months have been a good step forward for me. Kind of all spring seemed to have something going on, whether it was a small training crash or just struggling with the really high pollen that a lot of guys have been talking a lot about this year. And then kind of managed to get those couple weeks before California to reset, and it all started rolling well from there. And now is a bit different time of year. I'm really hoping to make the selection for the Vuelta, and there's a bit less time to train, just with a break after the Nationals and everything. So I'm a bit unsure how today will go and next week to an extent, but it's all kind of steps in the right direction, and I just need to show the team that in whatever it is from today, I think it's 3 weeks, that I'll be ready for my first Grand Tour. So
you know when that selection will be made?
No, I don't, but in the end it doesn't really change anything, because the focus is to be top condition and to come out of Burgos in a really good place. I'll go straight back to another training camp with my girlfriend directly from there, and just keep putting the hard work in. And it's weird when you've already had like such a good period in the year, because you're always thinking about trying to get back there and to emulate that condition you had. But it's also nice because it's probably the first time in my career that I know for sure that I need to just get back to that point and not further than that point, if that makes sense. Obviously you always want more, but that was kind of a point where I could say, this is a really good level to be at, and if I can take those legs into the end of the season would be perfect. So we'll see.
I'd say Theo Gegenhardt's got a good chance of making the Team Sky lineup for the Vuelta, wouldn't you? I mean, why wouldn't they? Why wouldn't they give him his first taste?
Absolutely. And it was interesting because he's one of these riders who's had a little, not a break, I'm sure, but he hasn't, since the Dauphiné, he's been gearing up for the second part of the season. And he was talking there about the difficulty of reaching a level that you're happy with, that a level that he's never been at before, and just maintaining it and sustaining it, rather than having to find another gear for this Vuelta. If he can go to the Vuelta with the sort of form that he's shown already this year, I think he can ride a very good Vuelta. I don't know what the Sky leadership situation is going to be there. Geraint Thomas was supposed to be at one point riding the Vuelta. Whether that will now change, I don't know. Chris Froome as well was talking about it, but I don't think that will happen. So it could be, I don't know what, I really don't know what the Team Sky lineup will look like at the Vuelta, but they have the chance of going for the third Grand Tour in one season, don't they?
They do, but I think it's going to be very difficult. And regardless of the roster they pick, can Geraint Thomas, if he rides? I mean, I think with the Tour of Britain starting in Wales, I mean that's a heck of a draw for Geraint Thomas. And I mean, I don't want to get into speculation over team selection issues, but you would think that would pull at the heartstrings, if nothing else, compared to 3 weeks racing around at the Vuelta, which is the sort of thing, you know, off the back of the tour, it's not the sort of thing you can really do lightly. Normally there's a kind of a predetermined strategy to ride Tour de France and then Vuelta. Has Geraint Thomas sort of planned his season that way? Who knows? But it would be interesting if, in a light team without real overall ambitions, it would be interesting to see how a young rider like Theo Gegenhardt got on, because there would be, relatively speaking, less pressure. But then there might also be, relatively speaking, less kind of focus, less opportunity to, really get stuck into a very clear and very specified goal. So it's going to be interesting to see. Could be different for Team Sky this time.
I think he thrives on that, Theo Gegenhardt. He seems to really enjoy having a job to do and doing it very well. That's something that he has done extremely well since joining Sky, and why I think he's fitted so well into that team. It will be fascinating. But we wait to find out what the Vuelta lineups are. Just one final word before we move on. I just want to say, I said it was Ben King's fault that the crash. I don't think that any blame should be attached to him. You know, the race was 5 hours old. Everybody was tired. These mistakes can happen. The consequences were dreadful. But, you know, I've seen Ben King getting some abuse on social media as per usual, and that seems very unfair indeed. It was a mistake.
Yeah, I mean mistakes happen every minute of every race, don't they? And it's the consequences of those mistakes which lead to the kind of backlash, if you like. I mean, you know, to Ben King, you know, it was a mistake, but you know, some mistakes, worse mistakes, don't get kind of punished in as bad a way, if you like. And that's bike racing, isn't it? Everyone is on the edge, everyone's on the limit. There's a kind of pressure for space on the road. You know, somebody takes their hands off the bars or looks round or whatever it happens to be, and suddenly other riders are on the deck. But, you know, the one thing you can say about every single professional rider is that, you know, they never intentionally cause one another to crash, because, you know, they're but for the grace of God, so to speak. I kind of hesitated there because, obviously, you know, we talked
rarely,
very rarely, you know, Gianni Moscon's kind of rash wave of the arm, which has cost him very dearly. You know, it's extremely rare that, you know, the riders know that their safety depends on their colleagues. And to see Ben King, who will be feeling terrible enough, you're getting a kicking on social media, is not, doesn't really exactly sort of warm the heart any, does it?
Kocze, sitele, kocze, kocze, biscine, nus picu deși cora, nus picu deși cora.
Do not adjust your sets. It's not the Giro, but that music is very evocative, of course, of the Giro. And we played a little bit of it to tell you about our show in November, on November the 12th. It's a Monday night at the Clapham Grand Theatre, a beautiful old big theatre in South London, where we will be doing a show with our friends Amaraterra, who have provided our Giro d'Italia music for the last couple of years. And this is something we've been talking about, well, for a couple of years now, and trying to plan it and arrange it, and finally it's going to happen, and tickets are on sale, and we're really, it'll be us plus friends of the podcast. We will announce the full lineup later on, and there'll be a special guest there as well. But really looking forward to that night, aren't we, chaps?
Certainly are.
Special guest.
I just said we'd announce that later, Daniel.
Is it me?
Oh, definitely not you. Oh my God. Hey, he cut a month on the telly. A month on the telly, and he comes in with that sort of attitude.
I'm just
But I don't understand. Is it a mystery guest or just special? Is it someone
special?
It's months away yet. We're in negotiations.
It was Matt White last year. He was an excellent guest. Will, you know, be somebody from the world of professional cycling. To be confirmed. How do we get tickets?
Tonkov?
What? Pavel Tonkov. An evening with... Is he as monosyllabic as he looks?
Oh, more so. I was delighted by the fact that Primoz Roglic is bearing a stronger and stronger resemblance to Pavel Tonkov, particularly on the bike. Enhanced by the fact that Primoz Roglic rarely wears sunglasses.
He's not as smooth as Tonkov.
Well, it's not Pavel Tonkov anyway with us and the Maratera. But if anyone wants to get tickets, and they're going pretty well, so it's act sooner rather than later, go to thecyclingpodcast.com/live-events or just thecyclingpodcast.com and then click on live events, which is in the tab either on the side or the top of the page, depending on how you are looking at the website. There's also a link to buy tickets for our other event in Cardiff later on in November, November the 27th at St David's Hall, the Cycling Podcast in Cardiff. And we're hoping to add some other dates for November too, but we're working on those at the moment.
An evening with Pavel Tonkov does have a certain ring to it, doesn't it?
So does an evening with the Cycling Podcast at Maratera and not Pavel Tonkov. Also has a certain ring to it.
It does.
A ring of accuracy. Anyway.
Actually, Ian Boswell had a very good Pavel Tonkov story from the Tour de France. Maybe we'll get him to tell us that one day. And that reminds me to tell you that we have also released a couple of Friends specials since the Tour de France. One is Ian Boswell's diary from the tour, which is really, really good and very insightful. He did a great job just recording stuff every day and sending it in. And we also released an extended version of Orla's Day with Rod Ellingworth, the Team Sky coach. She spent the stage to Alpe d'Huez with Rod Ellingworth and Zabi Artecha, the other Team Sky coach. And that's a fascinating listen, given what happened on that day and what it meant, really, for the rest of that Tour de France. And we've got more Friends specials coming. We've got another installment of the Espoir Diaries coming up in the next week. And also an extended version of my conversation with Andy Schleck during the Tour de France, which was released as a Kilometre Zero. But it was a much longer conversation, so we'll be releasing that very soon. Thanks to everyone who's signed up as a friend since the tour. There's been quite a lot of people signing up as friends. We're very grateful to you for your support. You can become a friend at thecyclingpodcast.com. So what else for this part? There are a couple of bits of business. I mean, one that particularly affects you, Daniel, is the Jan Ullrich news. And when I saw that Jan Ullrich had been arrested for trying to attend a party to which he wasn't invited, I immediately thought of you, because you, of course, are in Mallorca like Jan Ullrich, and I assumed that it was either your party or that you would be at the party, but I gather neither is the case.
No, although I did mention that, well, Jan Ullrich alleged that one of the guests at said party had karate kicked him. And I did.
You've got a karate kick story.
I've got a karate kick story. Well, it's not particularly entertaining. The last time I performed a karate kick, I used to do martial arts when I was, you know, just a lad.
Such a dark horse.
But the last karate kick I ever attempted was when I was about 12 years old, and I was being man marked in a game of football. And to the extent where my man marker even followed me to the bathroom, and this riled me over the course of about 45 minutes, so much so that I aimed a kung fu flying Cantona style kick at him.
It's not allowed, is it, in a football match?
No, but I was on the losing side of that, shall we say, because I broke my wrist. Anyway.
Were you sent off? Were you actually red carded for that?
No, it was a sort of an official game. Anyway, we're disappearing down the rabbit holes. the Jan Ullrich story. I mean, it's a tragicomic story, isn't it? I mean, a lot of the Jan Ullrich story ends up being tragicomic his whole career, or it can become that way, simply, you know, because of the weight problems that dogged him throughout his career. Came to be regarded as a sort of a Billy Bunter, clumsy, gauche, sort of woebegone figure in his career. And he was perennially to the bridesmaid, to Lance Armstrong. And, you know, obviously his career was curtailed in 2006, as most people know, when he was involved in Operación Puerto, never seen at a bike race again after that day. Mm. And since then, he has lived almost in, well, self-imposed exile, mostly in Switzerland, but a couple of years ago moved full-time to Mallorca with his family. I mean, I'm obviously writing a book about him and his life, but I first got wind of the fact that things weren't going too well for him, well, around about the time when the press started reporting on the fact that his second wife, Sara, who was the sister of a former teammate, Tobias Steinhauser, so this was Sara Steinhauser, she had, well, they'd apparently separated, and she had moved back to Germany with the couple's three children. This was in June. Things were not going particularly well for him, I heard. And then the news broke in the German tabloid press at the weekend that on Friday night he had tried to climb over the fence of his neighbour in Mallorca, and that neighbour happens to be a Hollywood film star, one of Germany's most famous feature film actors, Til Schweiger. And if you want to sort of live in exile, and if you want to stay out of the limelight, but you are going to go and crash people's parties, then it's not a great idea to crash the party of a Hollywood star, particularly in Mallorca, which Mallorca is considered almost another region of Germany. There's a sort of running joke in Germany that Mallorca is the 17th Bundesland, which is the sort of region of Germany, because there are so many Germans on the island. So the German press has a big presence in Mallorca, the tabloids all have sort of correspondence here, so they were obviously all over the story. And it was a very Jan Ullrich kind of story. He was photographed, filmed, being led out of a van at the police station in Palma with a bit of a gawky kind of grin on his face, but with his face also partially obscured by a makeshift shroud. And again, there was this sort of tragicomic element to it, but in actual fact, it's a very sad story about someone who has really been discarded and shunned by the German public, the German media, since 2006. There's been no kind of reintegration or redemption of Jan Ullrich. He's still seen as toxic, and he sort of accepted that verdict in a way. He's not really tried to rehabilitate himself or redeem himself. It's almost as though he's kind of assimilated the shame that Germany and the German press in particular wanted him to feel. And there are certain echoes of what's happening. I mean, I sort of sense an embarrassment about Bradley Wiggins' dealings with the press and the public now in Britain, and it's a completely different story. Jan Ullrich, it was a fully fledged doping scandal, and there were no, you know, he's since confessed that he doped for a large part of his career. But with the Bradley Wiggins, the Triumph Cinnolone TUE saga, has left both parties, both Bradley Wiggins and the British press in particular, feeling a little bit sort of sheepish about each other, and he doesn't really know how to deal with that, and he's almost exiled himself in a way that, to me, on a much, much, much smaller scale, echoes what Jan Ullrich has felt that he's had to do.
But yeah, I mean, there can't be anything more humiliating than being arrested trying to break into a party to which you haven't been invited, you know. I mean, that is as humiliating as it gets. If you were to write it, it's almost too far-fetched. But there were a couple of comments he made about having not seen his kids, I think, since April. And he's also said that, you know, that a drink problem and drugs problem was part of the issue why he behaved as he did on that night. So, you know, it is very, very sad and tragic for him personally. I was quite just struck by his age. You know, he's still a young man, you know, and again, this is a problem for sports people. Their lives are big part of their lives are over at such a young age. What do they do for the rest of their life? What does Jan Ullrich do with the rest of his life?
Yeah, and particularly when you think about how he identifies himself. I mean, for most sportsmen, it's hard enough as it is when they go from being a professional sportsman to being a former professional sportsman. He has gone from one day to the next on a day when he was the day before the Tour de France in 2006, when he thought that he was in the form of his life. He was going into a Tour de France that he thought he was going to win, and he actually planned to retire and win the Tour and retire, but instead he was implicated in the scandal and he became a former rider overnight, but also a former rider who didn't have and couldn't point to and couldn't even sort of feel as his own the 10 years of what had been a fairly glittering career. You know, don't forget, he was the first German to win the Tour de France in 1997. In 1997, he was voted Germany's favourite sportsman of all time, ahead of Steffi Graf, ahead of Steffi Graf, ahead of Boris Becker. And he was basically, well, he got the message and he was told, and he obviously took some of it on board, that he could no longer claim that as part of his identity. So then, what do you have? You have a black hole. And, you know, he already had problems in 2008 with what was referred to at the time as burnout syndrome. But on closer examination, it probably had a lot to do with how his identity had fizzled, had dissolved to nothing. And it looked as though he was getting his life back together. He was doing bike tours and in Italy, in Spain, and I think in Switzerland. But it was obviously built on shaky foundations to some extent, and they have now the sort of solid ground from under his feet has gone again. And I mean, I think I refer to the fact that it wasn't ideal, the worst possible circumstances that a Hollywood actor was involved in. It was in Mallorca, so therefore, of course, it made headlines. In one sense, I think that might be a blessing, because it's been all over the German press in the last 3 or 4 days. Even Lance Armstrong has come out of the woodwork to say that he's willing to help Jan Ullrich. So there's a sort of collective realization that this is a guy who's in a pretty bad way. But you know, that's not to say that everyone will kind of club together and lobby around him and saving. We've seen situations in other sports and in other and in show business, and you think of Paul Gascoigne in football, where these people, they seem to have this vast entourage and huge circle of friends and a huge circle of well-wishers, but it doesn't really solve their isolation.
There's never been a moment for Ullrich to sort of draw a line in the sand, has there? His career fizzled out, and the doping allegations and accusations and the confession all kind of came, but there was never a sort of rock bottom moment or a verdict that he was then allowed to, you know, recover from in the way that Armstrong has been able to sort of rehabilitate himself a little bit. Ullrich is just kind of, he exists in this kind of grey area of being neither a hero nor a villain, in a sense.
Well, and Rich, I always think that the guys who have been affected worse by the humiliation, it was self-imposed, it was self-inflicted humiliation to a large extent, because, you know, they were guilty of taking performance enhancing drugs and cheating. But the guys who have reacted worse have been the sensitive characters. Someone like Pantani, who, again, he could have come back 2 weeks after his failed hematocrit test and almost sort of unrepentant, which a lot of guys did. But the ones who have felt most contrite and, as I said, sort of assimilated some of the shame that the world has told them they should be feeling, those are the guys who have ended up the worst. And I don't feel that was ever really the case with Armstrong. I'm not saying he didn't feel any contrition or hasn't felt any contrition, but he's not the sensitive character that someone like Jan Ullrich is.
No, more robust. We should move on before we finish this week, because there was an interesting interview last week with David Lepartien, the UCI president, wasn't there?
There was, Rich. He wants to skyproof the tour, by the sounds of it.
I mean, Lepartien basically was reacting to what he seemed to think was a boring tour, and suggested six-man teams, budget caps for teams, and banning power meters. There were a few things that kind of spilled out of him, all of which seemed to be aimed at certainly reducing the influence of, well, Team Sky, or, well, a dominant team, but Team Sky have been that team in the last few years, obviously. And he specifically talked about, you know, the sight of a block of, you know, six, seven, eight riders from the same team riding on the front, controlling the race, closing it down. And he felt, I mean, we've seen some reported television figures from around Europe which seem to show that interest in the tour is down quite significantly in some places, and that he is drawing a connection between Sky's apparent control of the race and reduced interest.
Yeah, I think the TV figures is a little bit of a red herring, though not something that that shouldn't concern ASO in particular, because their entire existence depends on it's hugely dependent on TV viewing figures for the Tour de France, so I'm sure they'll be concerned about that. But I mean, without making this about us at all, our audience figures appear to be up for the Tour de France, which kind of bucks a trend. And I think that this is something that we're seeing across all sports, is people are consuming live sport in slightly different ways, or are beginning to consume live sport in different ways. And yeah, the future of a sport that kind of relies on people sitting down for 2, 3, 4 hours at a time, that's probably the bigger concern when it comes to television and the fading of the audience. People have busier lives, they have other priorities, and they want to maximise the kind of enjoyment they get from any time that they invest in sport. I mean, I know from watching other sports, this, once something kind of lost my interest, that's sort of it. You don't stick with stuff as long as perhaps we used to. And I think the Tour de France and many other races are addressing that slowly and quite sort of methodically. They're kind of experimenting. The very short stage in the Pyrenees, for example, there's kind of the grid start didn't really capture the imagination, but the fact that it was a full-on race from start to finish probably did. And I think the way the sport will evolve in future years, I suspect people will be encouraged to tune into these kind of marquee stages. I mean, nothing I think is less counterproductive, nothing is more counterproductive than the trend of showing every stage from start to finish. I mean, if anyone sat down and watched the stages 7 and 8, which Dylan Groenewegen won from start to finish, well, really they have only themselves to blame. I mean, the course tells you what the stage is going to be like. You know, social media can alert you if suddenly it's splitting in crosswinds. You can, you know, get it on your TV or tablet or whatever. That's kind of how people are now consuming sport, picking and choosing a lot more. So the fact that the TV audience is down doesn't necessarily mean they need to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I mean, what's the kind of logical conclusion to what Le Partillon said? What, reduce the team sizes down to 6 and just concentrate the power in the teams that can afford to offer bigger wages to fewer riders? I mean, that is what would happen. That's how kind of supply and demand economics works the world over, and it would happen exactly the same in cycling.
What specifically, though, do we think about the fact that Le Partillon's comments do seem directed at one team, and that this is part of a wider pattern? This is, I mean, a lot of people are talking about this, that the UCI president, the man in charge of the world governing body, I mean, there's no other way to say it. He does seem to have an agenda against Team Sky, does he not?
But the question is, what if Movistar, with their their three-pronged assault, what if they'd done to the tour what Sky did? Would Le Partillon have made the same comments? I suspect probably wouldn't. He would have welcomed the fact that there had been a sort of changing of the guard, and that we were seeing a different team and different riders dominating. You know, this is the problem, isn't it? You know, Movistar could ride in exactly the same way as Team Sky and achieve the same result, and the reaction would be completely different, I suspect.
And I think you just have to look back at cycling history, or not just cycling history, but the history of every sport, and you do get this ebb and flow, and you get periods of dynasty and hegemony by one player, one rider, one athlete, and then you get periods where there's a bit of a power vacuum, and I think it's unwise to throw the baby out of the bathwater just because there is one organisation that is richer, but it's also doing things better, while at the same time the bar is being raised and other teams are slowly getting closer to the bar. I would suggest you look at what Lotto Jumbo did this year, and you know that's all come from good sports science. Someone like Marijn Zeeman, he's kind of the head of physiology at Lotto NL Jumbo. I know he's done an awful lot of work, which has a lot of it as mimics what Team Sky are doing. Sunweb are very similar in the kind of investment that they're putting into planning, and I'm sure they're doing a lot of things better than Team Sky, or they're doing some things better than Team Sky in some areas. And you know, that's all part of the evolution of the sport. And you know, I talked about, I use the expression sky-proofing the Tour de France. Well, in professional golf, there was a period at the start of the noughties where there was a lot of talk about tiger-proofing the courses in particular, making them shorter or longer or tighter, and you know, with more rough, less rough. And none of it really worked, because essentially the parameters are laid out, rules are laid out in a sport in such a way that the best competitor is supposed to win. And as things stand, Sky are the best team, and they have found the best formula. And I don't really see that there's anything in particular that could be done in professional cycling at the moment. I think even with a salary cap.
Yeah, my question about whether, you know, David Lapartio has an agenda against Team Sky was slightly provocative, but it is a question that I've been asked on social media a bit. And yeah, there seemed to be a bit of an air of desperation about some of his comments last week. I mean, overall, you know, for supposedly a very polished kind of political operator, he has been guilty of some pretty loose talk, I think, in his brief spell as UCI president. He tends to say things that haven't been properly thought out or discussed with other people.
I mean, I think, ironically, you know, I felt from the start that David Lapartio has been very influenced by social media in particular. A lot of the sort of hot topics that are being discussed on social media, he will regularly seem to react to them, whether it be, you know, in the next interview or next press conference or whatever. And yet, on the other hand, I don't think, as is the case with an awful lot of people, and even us to a certain extent, is not fully used to, accustomed to, and able to deal with the way that single sentences or single paragraphs can be lifted out of their context and amplified on social media and then take on a life of their own. I mean, I'm looking at the interview that Lapartio did with the Swiss newspaper Le Temps now, and it was a very long interview, and he was trying to provide, well, a fair amount of context, and gave fairly expansive answers on various themes, including Team Sky and including TV figures being down, but in the course of fairly meandering answers, a couple of things slipped out which were liable to be scrutinized and amplified and look as though they followed the pattern that seems to have been established for a few months now of him criticizing Team Sky. I'm not sure that's what his intention was, but it just underlines the extent to which it really is a minefield communicating in this social media dominated landscape,
and having one team dominate the biggest race in the world over many years, that is a problem. I mean, I think it is a problem, but how you address it, I don't know. And I think there are two separate things: of having the best rider and having the best team. At the moment, Sky have both, and the really interesting thing will come when they come to the tour with the strongest team, but not the strongest rider, because you know ultimately it will come down to who's got the strongest rider. And if Tom Dumoulin is better next year than Chris Froome and Geraint Thomas, then then we could have a really interesting race on our hands. So,
and these things, these dynasties, these periods of domination, they can end, they always do end very suddenly. You know, you seem to be, you can feel as though you're contemplating this long, dark tunnel with no change in sight. And then, you know, to use the example of Tiger Woods, we know what ended that in 2009 with his sort of sex scandal. He's never won a major since. If you look at cycling in 1975, no one would have bet a single dime on Eddie Merckx not winning the Tour de France that year.
And likewise, 96 with Miguel Indurain.
Well, exactly. And that's how the Sky dynasty will end, I'm sure. And then all of these debates might begin to sound quite redundant.
Absolutely. The other, just briefly before we finish, I mean, the other thing that he confirmed that we kind of knew was that ASO knew that a verdict was coming on Chris Froome before the Tour, and yet still made moves to have him excluded from the race. And I think that is quite a big scandal. When they had been told by the UCI that Chris Froome was going to be cleared and eligible to race, well, he was eligible to race anyway, but that he was going to be cleared of his salbutamol case, and yet ASO still went ahead with the move to try and bar him from the race, at least publicly, that seems to me to be quite a shocking story in a lot of ways.
A bit naughty.
Anyway, shall we leave it there?
We should, Rich.
Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you, Rich.
Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
See you next week.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.